Donalana Kitchen talks about food. Donalana Kitchen talks recipes. Donalana Kitchen talks about lots of other things on community radio. Welcome to the Donalana Kitchen. This is Lana Nachtigal.
And I'm Donna Prisgintas.
We're here in the KHOI studio, and we get together here every Tuesday at noon to talk about food, farming, and
culture. Lots about culture.
Advice and opinions. And Donna and I have a fine time doing this. And we get by with a little help from our friends.
Oh, yes. Support comes from Wheatsfield Co-op, your full-service natural foods grocery in Ames. Community-owned, community-focused since 1974. Open daily, 7 a.m. to 9 p.m. Located downtown at 413 Northwestern, just off Main Street in Ames. Everyone can shop Wheatsfield Co-op.
And we do. So thanks to all of you who support this fine station. We just went through a pledge drive, and lots of talk was made of rhubarb and all sorts of things, and so we had rhubarb recipes. And I hope you are still enjoying rhubarb out there, too. All right.
Yes, we had the rhubarb sessions, and I was just talking to the fine man that put the whole thing together yesterday, and he said we could do another one in the fall, but he said he didn't want to call it the rhubarb sessions. And I suggested the rutabaga sessions.
Oh, that's good. I love rutabaga.
Oh, me too.
Although it doesn't make quite as tasty a pie as rhubarb does.
Well, maybe by that season we'll be wanting stews and kind of thing.
We'll work on it. So Donna and Lana Kitchen will keep you informed as to what's edible and enjoyable. And one of those things, enjoyable, is this radio station. We are community radio. And we are here downtown Ames in central Iowa. There's people all over central Iowa that listen to us. You said culture.
Yes, we've had a colorful transformation of our mainstream.
Right around the corner from KHOI Studio on Main Street, corner on the corner of Douglas and Main, there is a big building that looks like a tea cozy, to use a culinary sort of term. The whole building has been wrapped with little pieces of...
Yeah, knitted and crocheted squares,
It looks like little pot holders are all connected. And this was a wonderful project put together by Jennifer Drinkwater, Iowa State University Assistant Professor of Art and Visual Culture and Community Art Extension Specialist. And what a way to extend art out into the community. This whole building just looks so cute.
What do you think will happen when it rains?
It'll get wet.
Well, but I was imagining if the colors and some of the yarns might not be as fast and might start to blend and, We'll see.
Maybe that's part of the process.
It could be.
Life, death,
absolutely
passage of time.
Change.
It is. Oh, and
weather.
Here's the thing. Not just for your eyes, but as you're looking, if you stand across the street from this building, at the corner of Douglas and Main, on Main Street, you stand across the street next to Cynthia Duff the little parquet there, this little park there, a little tiny walk.
Right on the corner. Yeah. The corner park.
If you stand there, the lilacs are blooming, and you get this wonderful smell in your nose. I think they're the little French lilacs because it's a shorter plant, and there's a white one and a purple one. And I was looking at this colorful building, and my nose was just going, spring. So come downtown Ames for a sensation.
I thought you were going to talk about the peeing woman sculpture.
Oh, I am. All right. We can say peeing woman. Maybe that's on the seven dirty words. I don't know that.
Oh, Paul says it's okay. We're good.
Thank you.
We're not going to be censored.
It's always good. Yeah, Ames, Iowa has a nice program where they have sculptures come down and grace our main street.
Yes, and we have some new ones.
Yeah, some of them come and go, and some of them are purchased, and they move around. Again, on the corner of on the corner of Douglas and Maine, there is a large metal sculpture of a very powerful-looking, very abstract woman, kind of done in circles with her arms above, and her legs are turning around in a big circle, and she's sort of, I must say, she is sort of squatting is what she's doing. And it reminds me of camping. I don't know if it reminds me of
peeing in the woods,
It reminds me of peeing. So, here it is. We can celebrate that.
Well, but they put a bikini on her, didn't they?
Oh,
with the
they
little
did.
Squares.
As they were putting, it's not there now.
Oh, it's gone?
It didn't.
Oh, it was there yesterday.
But as the people were putting up the colorful squares on the front of the design on Main Building, somebody made a nice little bikini for her, which was very.
I saw it yesterday.
It sort of fit in with the whole corner.
Tied the whole neighborhood together there.
So, community art, community involvement, and this art piece, as I understand it, only happened because knitting and crocheting is becoming the thing. People are getting together and doing this.
Oh, good. We wouldn't want it to be a lost art, not another lost art. We're losing too many of them.
Right. So people are getting together and crocheting and knitting and doing all of this stuff. And people sent in their squares, and this is a group effort. It's like a big, crazy quilt.
Yeah, there are quite a lot of squares, so...
Yeah, it's over 1,000 on the front.
Oh, good.
Wouldn't you? Isn't that amazing? Isn't that just amazing? So, think of all those things. And this spawns a lot of other things. They call that yarn bombing places. You can knit things and wrap things and kind of take over. I say good for the knitters. Good for the knitters, yes. Well, also, I want to mention that we have some new recipes on Donalana Kitchen.
Oh,
on
yes,
the
they're posted. They're posted.
Yes.
I actually wrote them down. We got them up there.
Isn't that good? That's good. Donna sent in a recipe. I just love this recipe. And well, actually, she had two really good recipes lately. And you can find them at khoifm.org. Go to the talk section. Go to the Donalana Kitchen section. Pull down the little pull-downy part. Go to Donalana Kitchen and go to recipes. Or go to the archives. And you can listen to any past show because you just can't get enough. But the two new recipes are... Chocolate chip.
Cardamom.
Cookies.
There you go.
Cookies. And that is a dandy recipe. We talk about that. You said it is a modification of a standard.
Yeah. If you just take, I have to say a bit about recipe writing from my point of view because it is a specific skill that people kind of apply in different ways. You know, some people write down every last detail where you could possibly error. I am of the opposite persuasion, and I make it as brief as possible because sometimes I think the words are intimidating, and who wants to wade through them? So, for example, on this chocolate chip, cardamom cookie recipe, I say simply, use your favorite chocolate chip recipe. And I don't even say what that is because I figure most people either know how to make chocolate chip cookies and they have a way they've been doing it, or else you can just look it up like Google Toll House cookies or often it's on the back of the chocolate chip package, for example. So my recipe for that simply is you take that standard recipe, whichever one you like, and you... For a half a cup of the flour, you substitute. That means you reduce the recipe that you're used to. You take away one half cup of flour and you add one half cup of cocoa powder. And then you use dark chocolate chips and you put in some cardamom.
Cardamom. Yes, so that...
Ground, fresh cardamom. Right. So I don't say how much cardamom because cardamom is very tricky. Like, I actually applied this to a biscotti recipe last night, and I had run out of my ground cardamom, so I had to open some pods up and freshly grind them. Now, freshly ground cardamom is more potent, so you use less of it. If you've got a jar of cardamom that's been sitting in your spice jar for 6 months, well, you need to use more of it. If it's longer than 6 months, hello, folks, throw it away and buy some new. It does lose its volatile oils, you know, over a short period of time. So the cardamom amount, you kind of have to judge by how strong does it smell. And Lana pointed out I forgot to include something
Right, right. See, you were trying to be brief, and you got to the brief. I'll go back on the website and change this.
Because I do put cinnamon in it. I put Ceylon cinnamon, but you could put regular cinnamon in too if you don't have. Ceylon cinnamon is what's called either Mexican cinnamon or soft stick cinnamon. It's not as biting as regular cinnamon. It's a little more floral, a little vanilla-ish. Yeah, yeah. So
before we had CCCC cookie, chocolate chips, cardamom, chocolate chip cookies. Now you can add two more CCs to that if you want
Ceylon cinnamon.
So look for the CCCC.
We got a tongue twister going on here.
CCCC cookies.
And then I want to say we did post the lemon loaf because we had eaten it for Mother's Day with a rhubarb strawberry sauce and, and the black currant leaf whipped cream. So I posted that. Now, I took somebody else's lemon loaf recipe, which I credited on the website, but I cut that verbiage down by at least 50%.
It's very easy to read.
Yeah.
So check that out on the Donna Lana Kitchen page at khoifm.com.
Yes, and just know that in the recipes that I'm writing, I am trusting you to think for yourself a little bit here.
Good for you, Donna.
Yes.
We can all use...
Let's empower the cooks.
So, we're going to be talking about some books. Yeah.
Yeah. On the cold days when we're not really out in the garden, we've been reading.
Right, and there's so many good things to read. I'm going to be talking about pulses here to start out with. And there's a book called The Lentil Underground, Renegade Farmers and the Future of Food in America by Liz Carlisle. This is the Year of the Poor Pulses. 2016, the United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization has deemed this year the Year of the Pulses. And what are pulses, may you ask? Well, a pulse is a
beans.
It's a leguminous crop harvested for dry seeds. Not beans as in green beans, not peas as in green peas, or peanuts or soybeans for some reason, but any other kind of beans.
And they're specifically nitrogen fixing in the soil, which means you are giving something back to your soil when you plant them. Now, there's a reason, there's a method to the madness of the UN Food and Ag Committee as they're picking these annual themes, because last year, for example, as we well celebrated on the Donna Lana Kitchen, was the year of the soils, okay, because they were trying to draw attention worldwide to the importance of soil health. So the next iteration of that, which is this year, is the year of the pulses, because they are trying to say that a good way to improve your soils through agriculture is by planting and thus eating beans and pulses. So I'll have to go see what they're going to do for next year, because they are on a roll with this advertising campaign for the greater good of the earth.
Yeah, there's something called agroecology, which means let's learn how to do it a little bit better and give something
a little
back.
More holistically.
Right, right. And also these pulses, they're good for you. They're pulses are 20 to 25% protein by weight, which
very,
is a whole
very
lot
nutritious
more
food.
Weight. Yeah. So I ran across
inexpensive, easy to cook.
Yeah. And they, because there's so many of them, they're around the world. They have a broad genetic diversity.
And almost every cuisine has some very familiar beans or lentils or dal or.
And so they might be one of these handy things to know how to grow, and know how to grow well, because as climate changes, they're pretty hardy, and they have, like I said, broad genetic diversity to pick from. So they're adapting. They're adapting.
Well, and they're very easy to cook. Almost every one of them, you simply add water and boil.
That's good.
I mean, there's nothing to it. Pre-soaking is helpful, especially for the larger beans, like Put the water on overnight. Mm-hmm. Some people pour that water off, and then you boil them or simmer them. Mm-hmm. The smaller beans take less time. The larger beans take more time. And then seasoning, you can do whatever you want. They're very almost bland in their flavors. They're very easy to, like, doctor up.
Add things to.
Like garlic. Lots of garlic.
Garlic. We'll probably be talking about lentils and beans and things we can do And shows coming up. I ran across an interesting book and an interesting concept, an interesting bunch of farmers in a magazine called Yes, Y-E-S, Yes Magazine.
Yeah, that's supposed to be the positive, non-bummer news. Good for them.
Yeah, we could use some of this. And it was an article about what has been going on in Montana.
Yes, they're calling it a culture shift.
It is a culture shift. And the article is called Amber Waves of Lentils. Writer of the article is Raj Patel. And writing in Yes Magazine.
He's a well-known food writer. Very good.
And he talks about a book called The Lentil Underground, Renegade Farmers and the Future of Food in America. It's the story of, it's kind of like the story of what happened in Iowa. A lot of farmers started moving out to Montana. Oh, boy, let's grow something. And pulses were actually, they had a thriving pea harvest there in the 1930s.
They did.
But it fell victim to its own success because, like we tend to do, they grew too many of them, and a blight came and wiped out the pea harvest, and then something called futures markets started to come around. During the second half of the 19th century, the Chicago Board of Trade tried to standardize everything and tried to think, Montana's a good place for wheat. Let's do wheat. And as things happen, the Great Northern Railroad and James J. Hill, the owner of the Great Northern Railroad, thought, plow up all that prairie and plant wheat because I can move that and I can make a profit.
The market forces.
Yep, it's the market forces. So all the various diversified crops started changing out there in Montana. And yes, the railroad made money. And the Chicago markets wanted standardization. And then they made money. And then the Dust Bowl happened and everything blew away. So We've been kind of suffering in the Great Plains ever since. Things got blown away. And even though land-grant universities, think sustainability is a good idea, the powers of standardization and futures markets are still with us. So the real innovations come not from the big organizations or the big universities, but a bunch of farmers, believe it or not, got together and started to have improvement clubs, sort of like,
it's like PFI, Practical Farmers of Iowa.
They do it here. In Montana, they had improvement clubs, and they started to say, let's diversify our crops. There was one man 40 years ago named David Owen, O-I-E-N, I think it's Owen, decided to take a stand, and he dropped out of grad school and went to his family's 280-acre farm in Montana and tried some different crops. He started to do pulses, and he decided to study lentils. And he realized it was a good thing, and of course these things need to be learned and studied, and so he's been planting lentils.
Now, did he do that from the standpoint of putting the nitrogen back into the soil?
He's trying to make his own fertilizer, tolerate variable climates, and also
because the nitrogen that you put into the soil with a bean or lentil crop is not the nitrogen that's going to wash away and float down the Mississippi River and cause nitrogen. What's that called? Apoxia.
Oh, yeah, right.
Hypoxia. There we go.
So he has a brand or a business called Timeless Seeds and Timeless Natural Food. But the story of this book is called Lentil Underground. And the Lentil Underground is a lot of farmers working together to study this sort of thing.
Do they market together, too?
That's the tricky bit.
Collective marketing really helps.
Yep. Working together, the world can be bigger and richer if everyone is connected. Marketing, no matter how rich the loam or the soil is or how good your product is, you're still dealing with the Chicago Mercantile Exchange. So there is a movement not just to grow the stuff, but market the stuff.
Well, I have to say, like, from going to the Natural Products Trade Show, you see more and more products are being formulated with, for example, pea protein in dog foods and human foods, in snack foods. So they're starting to use – and other beans and lentils as well. It's kind of – as the farmers are growing it to improve the soil, the marketers are making it into more products because, as you said, it's a very high protein. It's a very good source of protein.
So it depends on what we, the eaters, decide to buy.
Well, it also depends on what we're offered to buy.
Right. So now there is a rather hefty bunch of folks working in this lentil underground to provide pulses, to provide things on a larger scale. And as they get larger, we're hoping the prices will settle out.
Well, but beans are not expensive anyway. Yeah.
But they are organic.
Yeah. Well, but even organic beans are not expensive. They are one of the cheaper forms of protein that one can buy. And, you know, we do think of them, of eating them all winter long in soups and stews and stuff like that. But you know what? Even in the summer, they make lovely salads, like lentil salads, bean salads, throwing them into a greens and vegetable salad. There are lots and lots of, and there's the ever pleasant lentil burger on the grill.
Well, actually, I think those are pretty good.
They are. That's right. What I mean.
Yeah. So there you go.
And even, I would suggest, if you don't want to be a vegetarian, you can pack some lentils into your beef patties, too.
They're good for you. And
it's better than hamburger helper.
Hamburger helper. Ooh, that's an oxymoron right there.
Well, if you use lentils for your hamburger helper.
That's a good help. Good stuff.
It works.
So it's people like Donna who cook that help us all along here. She'll tell us about
things. Well, because
we eat.
Ultimately, we grow these things to improve the soil, but we also grow them because we have to eat them.
If you want to find out more about this, I found out all about this. Well, from this magazine called
Yes Magazine.
But I Googled book, Lentil Underground, and it came up. And one nice thing is there is a connection here. There is a chef called Claudia. She has a restaurant called ClaudiasMesa.com, and she's one of the champions of the Lentil Underground. It's in Bozeman, Montana, believe it or not. And she calls it a boutique food emporium. And she combines a taste of Latin America and the Caribbean, working hard with the Lentil Underground to make things real tasty.
Well, that's the thing. The beans, you can go in. You can go Middle Eastern. You can go Indian. You can go Latin American. You can go good old Southern if you put in lots of garlic and some black pepper, salt, pepper. I like a little marjoram in my beans.
Soup, yes.
Oh,
yes.
Yeah. Beans are easy. Easy, easy, easy.
Yum. So three cheers to the people in the Lentil Underground and the people in Montana. They're using a little bit of their.
We didn't talk about the FART factor.
Oh, you want to talk about that? Now that. Okay, you better spell that.
Okay. So the problem is for some people, a lot of people, beans can cause you to be gaseous. There are a couple of things you can do about that. One is there's a product called Beano, which you just squirt into it, and that seems to work. It's an enzyme issue, basically. The other thing is, there are various suggestions from different cultures. Like the Japanese throw a piece of kombu, which is seaweed, into the beans as they're cooking. Other people say that if you bring the beans to a boil quickly, throw the first water off and put new water and start over again. The other one, the Mexicans have a really good one. There's an herb called epazote, which Lana grows, I think.
It grows like a weed.
And it is a weed.
It smells like old socks. But you don't need much of it, really, truly.
No, but if you cook it in the beans.
A pinch with the beans, it helps a lot.
A little pinche epazote. It sort of makes them more digestible.
I wonder if that's.
So there's tricks, guys.
I wonder
if it's
the same stuff that's in Beano. I wonder.
It could be the main enzyme. I really don't know what the chemistry is.
There's lots of things out there, and there's a lot of good things to enjoy. So we've been talking about the book, The Lentil Underground, it's Lentil Underground, Renegade Farmers and the Future of Food in America. It's a story of what's happening in Montana with some alternative food system folks
out
there.
We should ask the library to get that.
Yes. And the author is Liz Carlisle. She's a lecturer in the food systems at the University of California, Berkeley, and also a lecturer, get this, at Stanford University in a program called Thinking Matters. That's a nice program. I like that. And she's also been a former legislative aide to United States Senator John Tester, who's also from Montana, who's had some interesting things to say about food farming and equitability for all. Yes. So, think about pulses. This is the year of the pulses.
So do you have a song about beans or something for us, Lana?
Oh, what do we have? Oh, a lot of people know here. This is KHOI, FM 89.1, Story City, Ames. We're going to listen to a little music here from the Burlington Street Bluegrass Band, and it was written by Burlington Street Bluegrass Band banjo player named Bob Black. He wrote this one. But not, it's called the Nottoway Valley Breakdown. We're back. This is the Donna Lana Kitchen. That was a fine banjo tune by Bob Black and the Burlington Street Bluegrass Band, a dandy bunch of musicians over Iowa City way. And that's a Iowa born and bred song, Nottoway Valley Breakdown. Donna recently did a field trip and went to a lecture in Perry. What did you learn, Donna?
Well, the first thing I learned was that Perry has a restored Carnegie Library that is absolutely, they don't even use it as the library. It's right next to the newer library. So it's like completely a museum, and it is fascinating. They even have restored the real colors originally that were on the walls, and they have the children's room called something like the Room of Wonder or something. And in the basement, they have the ladies' room, which is called the Comfort Station, because when the library was built, you know, the farmers would come to town with their wives to do business, probably on a weekly basis, and there were no ladies' restrooms. So the women of the community requested that the library provide that, a comfort station. So the room is just lovely. And, of course, the bathrooms are perfect. But the room itself has, like, two rattan wicker kind of rocking chairs of the old style. And all the ladies' subjects are on the bookshelves. And the whole thing is just beautiful. And the basement also was used for about a 10 or something period as the local courtroom. So they have that set up down there as well. It's just – it's lovely what they've done in Perry. It's kind of right across the street from the Hotel
Pate.
So I went there because they were having at the newer library a lecture by an author called Stephen Drucker. Now, Stephen, I had read his book already. It's called Altered Genes, Twisted Truth. Now, the subtitle is How the Venture to Genetically Engineer Our Food Has Subverted Science, Corrupted Government, and Systemically Deceived the Public. So he was a very good speaker. He's a lawyer. He says, I nowhere in the book use the word conspiracy, nor do I target any particular company like Monsanto or anything. He's simply talking about the government, the way the government attended to this new sort of science. And he was a lawyer on a, some sort of larger legal suit, which actually forced the FDA to disclose their early research on this, scientific methodology. And what he found is, and this is in the book, and it's very, very interesting, is that actually the FDA in this case, now, the FDA is charged, legally mandated, to do the scientific double-checking of, you know, does this pose any safety risks to the public at large, right? So what Drucker is saying in the book, and he documents it very meticulously, is they did a really lousy job on this one, that they actually they kind of put aside the scientific findings of their own scientists. They went on industry supported, and they actually broke the law in doing this. Well, what he's saying.
It seems I have heard this sort of thing before. We just sort of ignored a few things, or we just kind of greased the wheels a little bit, or just it's,
well. And this original. The original legal framework that set all of this GMO stuff in motion happened in the early 90s. So we are already basically into our third decade of this. And so he talked about, you know, he didn't go for the usual shots like, oh, well, some people are making a lot of money or, you know, people were paid off. He didn't say anything like that. He simply maintains from his experience as a lawyer and going through the legal framework of all this, and he's detailed it in his book, he simply says that he personally feels that it's a combination of, at this point, of people not basically of ignorance. Like he was talking about how the FDA – somebody recently testified in front of Congress on some committee saying, oh, yes, it's perfectly safe. The GMO technologies do not essentially alter the product in terms of its, you know, effects on human and animal nutrition. And he goes, you know what? The science absolutely disproves that. So somebody in the audience said, well, doesn't that make a perjury? And he goes, well, not really, because probably the person saying that to Congress has just assumed that and doesn't really know any better. So there's at this point a layer of sort of, we'll call it intentional institutional forgetfulness or something like that. People really believe what they're saying, you know, like there was speculation of, okay, why does the Gates Foundation support this? Mm-hmm. And he said, well, people just don't know. They believe what they've been told. And they've been told repeatedly, and that's where it comes. He calls it systemically deceived the public.
Right.
And corrupted government because they – and subverted science is what he's saying. He also says the other element of this whole situation is – he calls it hubris, basically. Hubris on the part of the scientific community. And he's just saying, you know, basically there was a point when did he say? Maybe 60s, 70s, 80s, and where the chemists and the physicists were making a lot of progress in terms of, you know, producing mass conveniences and changes. And the biologists weren't making much headway. You know, biology is...
It's slower.
It is. Yeah, it's a lot of, you know, very natural. Not that it's all not natural process, but biology is. He said basically... changing genomes proved to be much more difficult than people thought, mm-hmm. than the biologists thought. Mm-hmm. And they really wanted their science to be as splashy as the chemists and the physicists. Mm-hmm. You know, we were at that point better living through modern chemistry and all of that sort of thing.
We've been to the moon and back. We haven't been there recently, but we've done great things.
So the biologists, they wanted to really have their day in the sun and put a lot of effort into sort of creating these what we'll call novel life forms. And even in the beginning of the book, that's Altered Genes, Twisted Truth, he talks about how the very first scientists who actually were able to accomplish this technology were careful about it. They went, oh my goodness, there's a lot of ethical implications here. This is, you know, maybe we should...
We're talking about our food here, folks.
Yeah. A very, you know, and we're also talking about, we're stepping into a realm of gene modification that does not happen anywhere in nature of its own accord. Yes, we have evolved and modified a lot of ways over time. You know, we grew corn from a teosinte, which was, you know, maybe 2 inches long. But we still did not cross the transgenic. We didn't put genes from one species into another, which is essentially what our current genetically modified things. So he talks about people who've been promoting GMOs have been saying, oh, no, we've been doing genetic modification for thousands of years. Yes, we have.
However, we
have not been doing transgenic modification. Mm-hmm. In nature, that does not happen.
Mm-hmm.
So without a lot of high-tech blasting and manipulating, we don't get a fish gene into a tomato, for example.
Right. You mentioned that we've been doing this stuff. Well, the transgenic actually going in there and monkeying around ever since, like, the early 90s. Did Stephen Drucker mention that what's been the success? Have we really had a great thing that has happened? I mean, do we have a product that we can look at and say, this
golly,
is...
we can't live with... No.
Yeah.
Well, he didn't talk about things like that. But you and I, you know, we can look around and we can go, okay, the biggest things that are happening on the planet right now are, of course, the corn and soybean genetically modified organisms. Now, there's a lot to be said. People are saying, oh, we're feeding the world with this. Oh, we're, blah, 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 blah. But in fact, feeding the world and getting rid of hunger on the planet does not have to do with the quantity of food we're growing. Everybody seems to be missing that point. There is a campaign afoot to disabuse people of that slogan, oh, we have to feed the world, because the truth is actually we have to distribute what we're already growing. It's a distribution problem. So on that level, no, GMO technology has not brought us anything new.
It has brought lawsuits because now all of a sudden we can own things that exist in nature.
Well, life forms used to can be patented.
Right? That's rather scary. And like I mentioned before, this is food system and things we put in our mouth.
And the other thing that's happened is initially when they brought these GMOs out, they were saying, okay, they've bred them to be herbicide and pesticide tolerant, or so that you can spray a lot of glyphosate, for example, onto them and get rid of all the weeds very quickly. Well, this sounds really convenient. However, what's happened is over time, glyphosate and other agrochemicals have been found to be not particularly good for the environment. We're killing off a lot of things in the soil. The soil biome, microbiome is kind of suffering. And this is something we're going to talk about on the show next week. Glyphosate, which we are spraying in heavy, heavy, heavy amounts here in Iowa and all the other Corn Belt states, now is a probable carcinogen. So we're finding out that because we were using these beans that are modified to take more levels of herbicides, we in fact have sprayed more of them, and this has been quite likely not a good thing for our living environment.
Right. So we're not just ingesting this stuff. We're kind of living in the middle of like you've often mentioned, Iowa is sort of ground zero for a lot of this tinkering around with things. We have a lot of commodities that are grown here.
Yeah, we live in a pretty dense fog of glyphosate around here. And next week we're going to talk about Pesticide Action Network has issued a new study on that.
Always good to be up on this sort of thing. You're listening to KHOI. This is the Donalana Kitchen, tasty radio for the heart of Iowa. More music from the Burlington Street Bluegrass Band. We're back. This is the Donalana Kitchen. If you have anything to say about glyphosate or pulses or what is on your plate, actually, if you have anything that you want to say to this fine radio show, contact us at khoiradio@gmail.com. And so we're back to Donna for some more talk about Altered Genes, Twisted Truth.
Yeah, Lana and I, we had a couple of books we're reviewing, and this one, yeah, it's called Altered Genes, Twisted Truth. The subtitle is How the Venture to Genetically Engineer Our Food Has Subverted Science, Corrupted Government, and Systemically Deceived the Public by Stephen Drucker. Now, he, actually, he's from Des Moines. He's a native Iowan, and he's a lawyer, and he's written this very specific book. And he will be, sometime he'll be coming to ISU in the fall. So we will announce that when it happens. I also wanted to mention there was another article that I just saw today online at grist.org. Because in addition to the GMOs that are already out there and we're growing widely here, there is a new technology called CRISPR, which is it is not transgenic, but they have learned how to It sounds so simple and clean. Switch on and off certain genes.
CRISPR. CRISPR even sounds good to eat.
I know. But it's a new technology coming to I believe the first CRISPR product is already on the market. I read that there's a mushroom out there that's been altered that way because the way the USDA or the FDA is dealing with this new technology, because it's not transgenic, meaning it's not genes from two different organisms. Mm-hmm. It's merely switching on and off the genes in an existing organism. So apparently they may not even have to be labeled, even if we have to finally label GMOs. So it's getting trickier. So this article in Grist, I want you you may want to look this one up. It says, you better learn about this new technology before it transforms the world. So part of the CRISPR is something now that's called the gene drive. It says, a gene drive is a new technology that gives us the ability to change an entire species at will. He says it's a bit tricky to grasp how this technology works, but we owe it to future generations to understand this stuff because gene drives are a freaking big deal. So in the article, there's a
unquote.
Unquote. There's a TED Talk, so there's a little video on there that explains the whole thing. Apparently, they're considering using it for mosquitoes, for example, to wipe out the possibilities of malaria and Zika. But they've learned that in 1 year they could completely change the entire genetics of every mosquito basically on the planet. It's might sound cool for mosquitoes, but
what else do mosquitoes do that we do not know about? And what are the bats going to eat?
Exactly, we got to feed the birds. But she also says in the TED Talk that's on this is at grist.org, she says that any animal with a this technology can be applied to any animal with a reproductive system.
I can think of some.
Yeah. Oh. I must say, after reading Steven Drucker and seeing the history of the way we've dealt with our initial genetic modifications, humanity is having a rather spotty record on this issue. So we're getting into some, as we would say, playing God here. And people use that phrase, and they've been using it rather dismissively. I think it's time for a new phrase because, it brings religion into it.
Also, playing God sounds like fun.
Like fun, exactly. And it brings religion in where really it's about ethics.
There it is.
You know, and ethics apply to all of us no matter what our belief system is.
Right. We are still dealing with our tinkering around with the atom bomb. We're still tinkering around the world and telling people what to do.
Lots of unintended consequences, and some of them in the instance of, could be bringing the nearing end of the species with global warming, climate change, as it were. We're on shaky ground here. We got to start thinking more profoundly as a species. I hope we can do this.
And as a species, we've got to start acting more ethically as a group, more morally, to kind of let this whole mess be dealt with by scientists and government bureaucrats as they exist now probably is not such a good idea.
Yeah, I think we got to go back to the old saying, question authority. If private citizens, the very least we can do is become much more well-informed and not like just say, oh, well, the FDA said it's okay. Really? They've made mistakes.
Let's raise our hand.
Yeah,
question authority.
A good place to start might be reading Altered Genes, Twisted Truth by Steven Drucker, or even easier, when he comes to ISU in the fall, we will let you guys know, and then all you have to do is show up for an hour, and you'll be pretty well informed.
Well, we should know. We should know. There's things being done in our name, and it's going to affect us all.
To us, for us, and by us, yes.
Right. There's some thoughts of how we are affecting the environment. And I guess that's kind of a theme today. We've been reading books and learning some things. There's another book that came into my hand.
Lon is going to bring up the bees. That's a whole other story that we love, and it's getting sadder and sadder.
It's getting sadder. It is getting sadder.
Because we're getting less and less of them.
Yes. And I don't know.
Bees are a little like mosquitoes. You know, they can be pesky, but oh my goodness, they're very important in the food chain.
Speaking of food, and we talk about food here on the Donalana Kitchen, it's not just the honey, folks. It's the pollination of everything out there that has flowers, all the fruits, and all the vegetables that need those bees to keep us going here. Here's some thoughts on bees from Bill McKibben. Bill McKibben's a great environmental activist and a good writer,
thoughtful
too.
Thoughtful fellow.
Yeah. He says the bee strikes me as full of metaphors. He talks about busyness. Yeah, busy as a bee. And then there's the community. That's a good thing, too. And then there's the democracy of how the bees go out and search for new places and they come back and share information. But Bill McKibben wants to highlight here, he says, something that seems less prominent, but one is something to consider right now. One is the role that bees now play as sentinels in an increasingly toxic world. They go out every day and surround the landscape and go leaf by leaf, petal by petal, and they're bringing back news in the nectar. And that news is not so good.
Sort of like the canary in the coal mine thing,
yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm. There's signals about new weather, about new patterns, about habitations. But bees also provide a beautiful example of how we might live in a slightly different way, because for millennia, people have been working with bees, taking the honey, working with bees. And not the bees don't have to sting, and we don't have to ruin them either. We don't have to kill them. They turn to the hive. We share the surplus, but only the surplus. And it's time to consider that is a lovely give and take. It's easily upset by greed or carelessness.
Oh, because the beekeeper has to leave
enough
feed the bees. Exactly.
Yes, always leave enough. It's a reminder that sufficiency can be among the finest words in our language. So that's something to learn. I'm going to talk here. Emily Dickinson wrote a poem, and actually you've probably heard this one, but she's written a number of poems about honey. And this is the one that is probably Honey and Bees. To Make a Prairie, It Takes a Clover and One Bee by Emily Dickinson. To make a prairie, it takes a clover and one bee. One clover and a bee and reverie. The reverie alone will do if bees are few. And she was writing in a time when if bees are few was not really thought of in the way that we are thinking.
Right. This week in the news, they released the sort of bee count that they do annually, and whatever the counting period was in recent, the most recent one reveals that yet again we've lost 40-some% of the existing hives. It's and they still won't exactly pinpoint, and maybe it's a multi-cause thing, but.
Time to
has something to do with all these pesticides we're spraying around and seed treatments and
right. So think of that. If bees are few, and if bees are few, I think it's time for us to raise our hand and ask some questions about modifying genes, about monocrops, about we're
taking
part of
more
this.
Than our human
taking
share on
more
the planet.
Than our human share. Yeah. So we've talked about two books today. One is The Lentil Underground, Renegade Farmers and the Future of Food in America by Liz Carlisle. And
Altered Genes, Twisted Truth by Stephen Drucker, Drucker.
Yes. You've been listening to the Donalana Kitchen. We've talked about GMOs and pulses and had a bee poem. A bee poem by Emily Dickinson. This is community radio. Your support is important. Listen to the Donalana Kitchen Tuesdays at noon at 7 p.m. Go to khoifm.org, stream, download, etc.
Find our recipes.
We'll go out with another Burlington Street Bluegrass Band. It's a tune called The Bluegrass Stomp. This is a Bill Monroe tune. Yes. This is the Donna Lana Kitchen. My name is Lana Noctical.
And I'm Donna Prisgintas.
Eat good food and enjoy life.